would you like to deliver breakthrough results through differentiated neurodivergent thinking? Today we have Todd Hagopian, and he will tell us all about that. And he's the Global VP of Product Strategy at JPT Marel and founder of Stagnation Assassins. And he recently published The Unfair Advantage, Weaponizing the Hypomanic Toolbox. And he has created over $3 billion in shareholder value through corporate turnarounds at five different companies. So Todd, tell us about how can someone deliver breakthrough results through neurodivergent thinking, and what does that even mean?
Welcome to Awakened Titans Podcast with Lily Patrascu, mind-blowing conversations with influential business titans sharing how you can manifest abundance, love, joy, success through quantum awakening, quantum manifestation, quantum healing, quantum miracles, exponential business growth, and innovative products and services.
Well, it starts with thinking about all the books behind me, right? All of the business leaders I know, they read the same 20 books, and then they implement the same strategies, and then they expect different results versus their competition, who are all doing the exact same thing. And so what I like to tell people is, in order to get breakthrough results, you have to use differentiated thinking. Now, my differentiated thinking and the frameworks that I put forward come from my battle with bipolar disorder over the last 20 some odd years. So 15 years undiagnosed, going through getting promotions and whatnot, turning around businesses, but not having a diagnosed condition and dealing with that. And then 8 years of kind of bottling that up and coming up with the frameworks that help me put this together in a way that I can teach others. But those differentiated thinking frameworks come from neurodivergent thinking, and there's value to that. You know, people who think differently inherently will break the mold and will come up with orthodoxy smashing ideas. And it's so important in business to realize that the easiest way to make money is to take a really boring old business and to do something completely different inside of it.
Thank you. Give us an example of how you applied neurodivergent thinking into the businesses that you have worked with and the kind of results that it has had. Give us three examples of different thinking versus what most entrepreneurs might try to do.
Sure. So I think the first one would be grandiose goal setting. Okay. So part of being bipolar and part of being neurodivergent and many of these neurodivergencies is grandiose thinking. And a lot of people in business poo-poo that, and they say, you know, under promise and over deliver. And I always say under promising and over delivering is for losers. You know, if you promise 6% and you drive 9 and I promise 16 and I drive 14, I missed. But I'm going to be the one that gets the promotion. How do I know that? Because I give promotions all the time. So I know who they're giving promotions to. They're giving promotions to the guys who drive hard and just barely fall short or find a way to hit it. And so that's grandiose goal setting. And so for an example there at a scale company, we were developing a new scale. They actually had already developed it, and it was being sold as a break fix. So a scale breaks, you bring in a new grocery store scale and you sell them that new scale. We found out that there was a feature in the scale that no one was really talking about because the engineers just kind of put it in there that allowed the scale to weigh just a little more precise. And what that allowed is for the grocery stores to make just about another penny or two per transaction. And so it was like a bad 80s movie, right? Where, like, you know, you make a penny every time somebody buys a piece of meat, you know? And so what we did is we thought big, and we completely changed how we went to market. And instead of selling people one scale at a time, we'd go in there to talk about that one scale, but say, hey, if you were to change 2,000 scales in your network, this is how much money you could actually make. You could take this scale and turn it from a piece of equipment that you have to pay for to a piece of equipment that pays you. Turn it to, you know, from a brick to an ATM machine. And that's essentially what we did there with that grandiose goal setting. Another example would be the Karelin method, which is activity times efficiency times focus equals results. So it's basically an extreme productivity method. A lot of people talk about activity times efficiency, right? It's really easy. Just work more hours and get better at your job. Like, just tell your employees that and you'll be all good, right? And that's what we were taught for years and years. So what we did is we added a third dimension to that, and we fixed efficiency. So activity is still working a bunch of hours, right? efficiency, though, is getting more efficient, and technology has allowed us to do this in a lot of different ways, whether it's systemizing, automating, using AI, outsourcing. And then the focus part is the really the key to this is think about the things in your business that only you can do, things that make the most money and that only you're capable of doing. And then take a look at your calendar this week and see how many hours you're spending on those things. Chances are it's going to be between 4 and 8 hours if it holds from all the calendars I've looked at, right? So 4 and 8 hours of your 40 to 50 hours to 60 to 70, however many hours you're working, are spent doing the things that only you can do. And the key there is that if you can go from 4 to 8 to maybe 34 to 38 hours spending on those key things that are making the most money, you can make 8 times more money. And if you have a 150-person organization and you get everyone to do that, you can make dramatic turnarounds in not a whole lot of time. So one company we did this at, we had a big town hall and we said, all right, if you can cancel a meeting, take a look at all your recurring meetings. If you can cancel a meeting, cancel it. If you can shorten a meeting, shorten it. If you can reduce attendees, reduce it. If you can turn it into an email, do that. If you can turn it into walking down the hall, do that. And what ended up happening is we saved thousands of hours of meetings in 1 hour at a time and start canceling stuff. And so thousands of hours times these people that make $200 an hour is millions of dollars, right? So that's what ends up happening. So that's a second one. Third one would be orthodoxy smashing, which I touched on already. And it's basically thinking about things that in your industry are considered law, but might not be. And you go through them systematically and ask, what if that weren't true? How would we respond if that was not true? So for example, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, nobody would have let some stranger drive them from point A to point B just because it's faster and cheaper. Okay, but now I haven't taken a taxi cab in 5 years, right? I constantly let strangers drive me from point A to point B just because it's faster and cheaper. Orthodoxy broken. 10 years ago, nobody would want somebody to pick their groceries, you know, and bring them to them because they didn't trust them. Today, grocery delivery is the fastest growing segment in the grocery market. And so things like that. We did it at appliance manufacturer where they said, you know, this is probably 20 years ago. So think about today going in and buying a washer and a dryer and you see all colors, right? Silver, black, you know, all these interesting chrome and everything. Well, 20 years ago, that wasn't the case. Everything was white. We were the first ones to come out and say, we're going to do color and put it on the floor. And what ended up happening was amazing. People not only liked the color, but they actually started buying both. So you used to go and buy just a washer or just a dryer, whatever is broken, and it would go ahead and fit in next to the white one that you had. But if you've got a white dryer at home and you want to buy a chrome washer, you're buying a chrome dryer too. So we ended up doubling revenue in every one of those sales, 100% attachment rate instead of 30. So it's just different ways to think about things and package this up into frameworks that you could use regardless of whether you're bipolar or neurodivergent or what. It's just about thinking about things in a different way. Does that make sense?
Yes. So tell us, how can entrepreneurs leverage this kind of neurodivergent thinking for their own business? Give us like 10 commandments of where someone would start to look at the ways to implement different things that will make the massive difference. Yep.
And it's a great question. So I've actually founded a company and from a startup standpoint, I bought a small business and doubled that and sold it. And I've used this in the Fortune 500. So different ones work better for different size companies, but that Karelin method works really good for founders to figure out what their founders are, where the worst, right? At like running after the shiny ball or trying to do everything ourselves or not wanting to push it off to other people. That's like our worst trait, right? So really figuring out what only you can do is probably the number one way that you'll make money founding a company and making sure that you're outsourcing or killing. And that's an important one here. And this might be a good framework to just touch on is a rich person once told me this and it's always stuck with me. Poor people add, billionaires multiply. Rich people multiply, billionaires subtract. So the idea is you read a bunch of these books, you grab a couple things, you add it to your portfolio, you add, and all of a sudden you get 80 hours of meetings, you know, and you're doing all this activity, but you're not making money. Rich people will multiply. They'll take some of these things, they'll they'll attribute it to some of the things they're doing and figure out how to make those more productive. But billionaires, they subtract. And what they do is they look at their calendar, they look at all the things they're working on, they look at all the products they're selling, and they take away. And they focus on just the things where there's the biggest differentiation, where you can draw the most premium, and where you have the least competition. And that's how they make all their money. And that's a really important thing for founders, because we often will, you know, this is our goal, this is our goal. Oh, $100,000, and we run over there and we have a new goal. We completely change our plans just because there's a check. But in reality, you have to look at the big picture, at what you are going to be known for, what you are going to be good at, and what you're going to plant your flag in, and really drive that home.
Thank you. Tell us where you find that entrepreneurs make the biggest mistake, because you mentioned about the 20 books. I'm wondering about which 20 books you're talking about. That I'm reading, first of all, as a basis and foundation for creating a successful business. And what would you say is going wrong from those specific books? Like what kind of like 10 commandments of, of mistakes you can say that entrepreneurs tend to follow, and then they are surprised that there is so much competition and of everyone doing the same thing. What are those kind of books, and what are those kind of steps that they follow that are big mistakes that generally lead to failure or less profit?
Yeah, so I think by far the number one problem with entrepreneurs, the number one mistake we make, is continuous improvement. And you'll hear it all the time from an entrepreneur, like, I don't have a big enough team to do continuous improvement, or we always start stuff and never finish it, or, you know, all these books are telling me to do these big things, but my continuous improvement's only $200 here and $100 there. But the key is this: if you do continuous improvement the way they teach you, it's these big projects, you know, massive cost changes, process changes, this and that. You'll pick three projects. You'll run them all year long. You're going to take your best people, and most entrepreneurs don't have that many people, so they're going to take their best people and put them on these projects. So now you're taking your best person, and instead of letting them work 50 hours a week on the things that only they can do, you're taking 30 to 40% of their time, putting them on this project that's going to take 12 months and not pay off until then, if it's successful. So with our continuous improvement, we do short 6-week projects to knock out one thing. So you might have 15 things that you want to do to cut down lead time. We do a 6-week project to cut down the thing that's going to cut down lead time the most. Do that project. Then you move to the next project, a different leader. So it's not the same person all the time. It's just a couple hours a week out of each person. Move to the next project on the next biggest thing. Because what you're going to find is that the fourth thing that you thought was going to be the most important isn't. By the time you fix the first three, something else is going to pop up. And that's actually the most important now. And so by doing these short bite-sized projects, A, you start, finish, and you put stuff in the bank. So now you're starting to get some returns and getting some compounded returns as you get more and more. And then B, you actually work on the stuff that is driving the most money, because you're going to be wrong, if especially in small businesses, if you try and pick what's going to be the most important thing for the next 18 months, you're going to be wrong. You have to knock out what's in front of you, then get the next biggest one, and then the next biggest one, and keep doing that. And so our program preaches 52 projects in 52 weeks, led by bunches of different people. Get everybody involved and don't harness your most productive people with all this work, because that's the opposite of what you need to do in a small business.
Thank you. Isn't it a little bit idealized that you will get your best people to only do what they're really great at? Because really, you have to do some tasks that you have to do. Like, is it really realistic that you can get someone to actually clear their calendar of all the different things they're not so great at, but somehow, like, there's admin, there's different things that have to be done. I don't know, how do you even like delegate all of those different things, that especially in a smaller business that doesn't have like 100 employees, that has like 2 or 5 or 10 max? How do you manage that?
Yeah, in 2026, I'll say that this has gotten much, much easier and much, much more important, because you're right. You know, I only had 12 people in my business, and so I've got 12 people. There's all kinds of stuff to do, right? But what you find is that this thing that I'm not that good at, that no one's really good at, and we kind of work on, like, let's say taxes or accounting or this and that. Okay, so we're all trying to figure out QuickBooks and this and that. They're now are people that you can outsource this to for such a minimal amount of money. And it might seem expensive, like let's say $200 a month. It might seem expensive, but when you add up all the hours and all the salaries of the people that are working on it right now, and you can outsource that for $200, and you think about, what about those 18 hours? How much would that drive back into the business if we outsource this for $200 and we let them work 18 hours on the things that only they can do that are driving the most money to the bottom line? And you'll find out that that trade almost always makes sense, especially today in the world of software as a service and AI and automation and systems. These things are dramatically cheaper if you can go to people who know what they're doing and do it all the time, rather than try and make your best person spend 6 hours figuring it out.
Thank you. How did you come up with this stuff? Like, how did you?
it was interesting. Like, I developed it as I was going through the bipolar struggle, and then as I got cured, it was like, okay, I need to replicate this so that I can do it, because now I'm on the medicine and I don't have this outside the box thinking. Like, the medicine really shut that down, and so I had to bucket it and systematize it so that I could do it for myself, and that's why I now can do it to other people. But the important part here is, when I moved away from the Fortune 500 and bought my own company, that was where this really triggered. Why? Because I was implementing it all in a turnaround, and every dollar of it was coming out of my bank account. So your audience will, you know, understand that, like, every dollar is yours. So if you make a mistake, you lose money. And if you do well, you make money. And what that did is it really got me focused on, okay, do I want to pay somebody this, or do I want to do it myself, or do I want to clear my calendar and do the 50 hours, like, dead on the things that I know are going to make me the most money, or focus on the customers that are going to make me the most money and get rid of the other ones. You know what I mean? Those are hard decisions to make when you're a small business owner, but they are the most profitable ones that you will make. And that's all inside these frameworks.
Thank you. What do you feel needs to happen on a mindset level, in terms of a mindset shift, that will allow someone to deliver breakthrough results through neurodivergent thinking? And what I mean by that is that for many years, there were certain tasks that I thought only I could do. Mm-hmm. And it's only at the end of last year that I realized, oh, actually, yeah, I could ask, you know, this lady to do this thing for me. Yeah. And that would clear, like a full day of my calendar. Yeah. And I mean, what can I do in a full day? Yeah. Okay. Why did it take, like, I'm 44 now, okay?
Yeah.
Like, why did it take me, like, 20 years to figure this out? It's stupid, you know? I'm thinking about it now. I'm like, how did I not work this out? Why is it, like, such a basic thing and what was it within me that kind of stopped me from seeing how easy it was for me to, like, delegate this thing? What do you feel needs to happen on a mindset shift level? Understand that actually there are certain tasks that can be delegated from the ones that they think, oh no, actually only I can do this thing.
Right. Yeah. I would say, I'll start with my mantra, and it's going to sound a little greedy, but I'll wrap it back up here. But how I go to work every day is, I say, I'm going to make as much money as I can every minute today. That's how I go to work every single day. I'm going to make as much money as I can every minute of the day. And the point of that is to keep yourself focused on what you're doing and what result it's driving. And as you start looking at your business that way, you'll start realizing that even if you have to pay a lot of money to get those 12 hours back a week, it's worth it. Do you know what I mean? And now, to answer your question, in today's world, like, it used to be that we would open up the world book, right, and try and figure out, like, how does this work? You know, then you get the internet, and if you search right and you find the right corner of the internet, you find out that somebody might do this for you. But now, with the advent of AI, I really encourage people to use AI as more of a productivity booster in figuring out how to do things. So if you were to say to AI, this is what I'm trying to accomplish, what are the 10 ways that I could do it? 7 of those ways will end up being some form of outsourcing, right, that you don't even know exists, right? So I launched this book. I didn't know that there are people that could write or could run the book launch for you. So I spent months just researching everything you're supposed to do to launch a book and doing all this stuff and teaching myself this and teaching myself that. And then I find out for $100 a week, somebody will do it all for you. You know what I mean? That would have saved hundreds of hours, but I didn't apply the framework to that because it was kind of a pet project. You know what I mean? It's if that was at work, that's the first thing I would have done. It's been like, who could I farm this out to? You know, and so that's the attitude to take to it. It's not trying to get stuff. It's not trying to be selfish with your time. It's trying to be productive with your time. People don't complain because they have to work an extra half hour. They complain because they wasted 2 hours during the day on pointless stuff and then had to work an extra half hour. So it actually helps your team as well. Getting into this mindset, people will feel more accountable and feel more actionable and feel like they're driving more to the job.
Thank you. So how can someone actually figure out that there are certain things that they don't have to do? Because it took me 20 years, more than 20 years to figure this mm-hmm. out, you know, like that there are certain things. And it's like 20 years ago, I remember, I'm not sure if really 20 years ago, maybe 14 mm-hmm. years ago, I read this book of Tim Ferriss, and it was about how to basically delegate your life. And at the time, yep. it's really funny, I was a nanny. So I started mm-hmm. delegating my own house cleaning. And it's kind of stupid mm-hmm. because I was cleaning someone else's houses, you know, other people's houses. Yeah. And right. and then I had other people cleaning my own house, but it was at a cheaper price. So mm-hmm. I was still making a profit. And then when I was getting home, I was actually coming to a clean home yeah. that was perfectly organized in a very OCD way. And yeah. also I had all my clothes lined up by color in my yeah. wardrobe. So it gave me an intense feeling of yeah. satisfaction mm-hmm. knowing that I had delegated something. Although, you know, as a nanny, how much can you delegate? But it took me still like so many years mm-hmm. to do this mindset shift. And I do think that, you know, like I had like virtual assistants for at least like 8 years. So I have delegated a lot of different things. But why did it take me another like 8 years to figure yeah. this out? Like I can do this tiny bit, like I can get one of them to manage each other. And then, yeah. you know.
And it's so funny. I mean, it's just like the book story, right? Like I know all this stuff and I still didn't look at that first. Because it wasn't top of mind. So what I tell business owners to do is write down the 10 things you're going to do this week, 10 things you're going to spend the most time on this week, and be honest, look at your calendar and get it from there, because your calendar doesn't lie, but you do. You know what I mean? So take a look at your calendar and see what you're spending the most time on. And then I had this, a great boss at Whirlpool one time told me this, and then cross out the bottom three and just don't do them and see what happens. See how many customers complain, see how many sales you lose, see how many, you know, things, you know, don't get done. And what you'll find is that everything goes fine. Maybe you have to spend an hour here where you were going to spend four just to get it straightened up. You know what I mean? And that's at that point is when you know that those things can either be killed or outsourced. Then you do the next three. And do the same thing, outsource or kill, and go right through. And if you purposely focus all your time on the three or four things that are making the most money, and then everything else, you go through this purposeful outsource or kill mentality, you can decide whether you're just going to get rid of it and not do that product or service or customer anymore, or whether you're going to see if you can outsource it out and maintain 80% of the profit, but get back 100% of your time. And that's a huge trade that you should make every time.
Thank you. What are some of the most stupid, yet very simple and amazing techniques that you've leveraged in order to grow your business or other people's businesses that were like so mind-blowingly simple, yet most people just don't know about them? Aside from everything you shared, which is, you know, a lot of it is kind of common sense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the two that come to mind right away are the orthodoxy smashing, which is just, it's kind of fun, right? You think about all the rules that are in your industry, the laws that are in your industry, and you just say, hey, what if that wasn't true? What would we do? And you spend just a little time kind of running down that rabbit hole. What would we do if that wasn't true? What if lead time didn't have to be 12 months? Like if we needed to make lead time 6 months, what would we do differently? You know, maybe we'd hold an extra $200 inventory. Maybe it'd be $100,000 inventory. Don't know until you ask the question and kind of look at it and see if it's something possible to change. You know what I mean? And then the other thing would be engineering. And I know not all small businesses have it, but I'll touch on it just because it goes into this same methodology. But you really need, there's certain functions, like I would say engineering and supply chain, maybe even finance, where they really need to be profit-oriented functions, and most people treat them as a cost, and they treat them as something where they're going to need more as they get bigger. And that's not really how these functions should work. They should be very profit oriented, which means they have to be prioritized from the people who are driving the decisions on how we're going to make money. So for example, in a bigger company, like I might have an engineering department that I take over that has 80 priorities. They've got 80 things they're working on, just this long laundry list, and they're all working on whatever they have time to do, whenever they have time to do it. They all know the different things, and they bounce back and forth like crazy. Well, multitasking is impossible, right? Your mind is really just flipping from one thing to another. And every time you do that, it's like a changeover on a machine where it takes some time to get back up and running. It takes some time to get back up and running. When you do prioritization right, the person who's in charge of today's margin and tomorrow's margin should be making the trade-off decision and say, you know what, these 13 things here that are easy and small and have to be done don't have to be done today. These six projects over here is going to be what makes or breaks our year. And I want every hour spent on those six projects until we clear one, and then we'll bring one of these up in. And that mentality in every part of your business is going to make you more money than a good strategy will.
Thank you. Tell us what other concepts or techniques you've implemented in different companies to deliver breakthrough results for them.
Yeah, so I think the 80-20 is probably worth talking about a little bit. So a lot of people know the 80-20 rule, the Pareto principle, basically is 20% of your activities will drive 80% of your results. And this holds from anywhere from profitability to safety to HR stuff. Like this tends to hold. But what people often do is they use it as lip service and they say, we're an 80-20 company. We focus on if they do it right, we focus on the 20% of things that drive 80% of the results. A lot of people do it the opposite, don't understand what 80-20 means, and they say we focus on the 80% of things that are most important. That's not what 80-20 means. So a true 80-20 company will actually not only just focus on the 20% that drives 80% of the results, but they'll systematically eliminate the rest so that they can put more hours into that 20%. So let me give you an example. A true 80-20 company is going to take all their customers and they're going to rank them from highest to lowest revenue. So the highest over here and the lowest over here. Then they're going to rank all their products and do the same thing, highest to lowest in revenue. Okay, this top 20% of your products and top 20% of your customers, where those intersect, that's your true 80. That's usually going to be somewhere between 64 and 80% of your profitability. And it's only 20% of your customers and 20% of your products. And so, but what will often happen is people will actually give those people the worst pricing because they tend to be easier to deal with. And so they don't negotiate as hard in many times, and they actually end up getting worse pricing. These hard customers, the small customers and the small products, will get the best pricing. Why? Because that product is not right for that customer, or that customer is asking for different things and you're trying to get the sale. So you end up giving them preferential pricing over your best customers and your best product. And then those small customers and the small products drive enormous complexity into your organization. Just hours and hours of extra work that you don't have to do when you're selling the same thing over and over and over again. And so you end up charging less for something that takes dramatically more time, and you're making a lower profit and sucking all these resources out of your organization that should be put towards the top 20 of each, the A customers and the A products. And that's what a real 80-20 organization looks like. And you can do this if you have four products. You can do this if you have 400 products. You can do it if you have three customers. You can do it if you have 300 customers. It works either way. But the point is you need to know your profitability by customer and your complexity cost by customer. How hard is it to serve that customer? And if it's hard to serve that customer, then their price goes up. And if it's hard to make that product, then you need to raise the price on that product, or you need to outsource it, or you need to kill it. And you need to get down. Again, it's all about focus. Get down to that A customer, A product mentality, where you could, I've been in businesses where you could cut all of the B product, B customer category away. And it's about 60% of the work but it's only about 5% of the profit because there's so much that goes into managing that type of relationship. Does that make sense?
Yes. And tell us, what are some of the biggest results that you've seen from people that have implemented this kind of neurodivergent thinking into their companies, with your help, aside from everything you mentioned already?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, three out of those five turnarounds, we doubled EBITDA in less than 2 years. So doubled profit in less than 2 years. And these are, I mean, it was a $2 million small business all the way up to a $100 million large business. So, and everywhere in between. So that's kind of the results that you can get if you implement all these things and you really focus on making money all the time and being willing to do the hard work and trim the other stuff and improve the other stuff and set bigger goals and go after it and get the whole team thinking. We've got a raise your hand rule that's really important. And we basically say, here's the nine goals for the next 5 years. It's usually 3 1-year goals, 3 3-year goals, and 3 5-year goals. And if you're ever not working on one of these nine goals, raise your hand and make your manager explain it to you. So you have to be able to articulate why they're doing it. Sometimes, like you said, it's just gonna be like, hey, we got to do taxes and we haven't outsourced it yet, so you got to do it. You know what I mean? And so, but a lot of times this will actually flag something to the manager that they don't realize you're spending a bunch of time on. Maybe you're doing the same report six different ways because six managers like to look at it a different way. You know what I mean? And this is where you can really cut down on the fat and focus on the dollars.
Thank you. What's the best way to actually kill a project that you started? Because I can't imagine like firing a customer, actually. Like, how do you even do that?
Yeah, so the easiest way, I don't fire many customers. I will let them self-select. So, for example, I walked away at one point at Whirlpool. Lowe's, who's obviously one of the largest, customers of appliances, they said, if you give us this price increase, we're going to kick you off the floor. And I said, that's fine. And they kicked me off the floor. And 2 years later, I got it back at a much higher profitability. And so sometimes it's a long game, but most of the time it's not quite that dramatic. You go with the price increase, you decide how much you deserve to get paid for that amount of complexity, and you go with the price increase or a simplicity red rule. So what that looks like is you're buying this thing for $20 today. I decide it's $28. That's the only way I can make money, given all the complexity that's in it. You can buy it for $28, or I can move you to this product over here that everyone else is buying, and you can get that for $19. So you can get it a dollar cheaper, but you got to go to the one that everybody else is buying, not your curated special individual product. If you want that one, it's $28. And oftentimes, what will happen is you'll get about 30% of people that'll switch over to the other product. Especially if they hear people like, Lowe's is buying it. Okay, I'll go over to this product. You'll get about 40% of people, surprisingly, that'll pay the extra money. And then another 30% of people that'll walk away. 30% of people that walk away, great. You just saved a bunch of time that you can dive right back into your more profitable projects. The ones that stayed and paid the extra money, great. Now you're getting paid for the complexity. And the ones that moved over and got into the one that you want to make all day, every day, even better. And so this is every time I take over a new group, we pull people. And almost universally at every company, one of the issues that drives the employees the most crazy is not killing a bad project or not killing a bad product or having to deal with a bad customer. Those are the things that are actually culture killers. Right. The employees hate it. They can see ahead of time that this project's not going to work. They know that this customer is a pain and he's not worth the money based on how much work they're doing. You know what I mean? And they know that this product is never going to make it. It has to be replaced by something else. But yet people are so hesitant to kill things that they'll keep it alive, hurting their own profitability, hurting their own culture. And eventually those two things lead to really bad consequences inside of small businesses and big businesses.
Thank you. Tell us, what are the worst interpretations of neurodivergent thinking that people have tried to implement in their company and they really haven't? Like the let's say the 80-20 Pareto rule or some other concepts, but if perhaps implemented incorrectly that have led to wrong results.
Yeah, it's actually a great question, because so many people have tried to do the 80-20 and they have one bad experience and have walked away. And what I tell people is there's this one part of the 80-20 that they don't really teach, but the people who do it right know it inherently, and it's called the logic filter. So there are times when something is not in your, like, let's say there's a huge customer out there, but they're not in your top 20. You have never sold anything to them before. Well, should you act like they're a small customer just because they're not in your top 20? No, right? Like they are a top 20 customer, so you treat them that way. Okay. I used this one example the other day on a podcast that I was hosting, and I said I went to a gas station. I was out of gas, and I walked in, and they didn't have a gas can. Sorry, I was out of gas in another car, so I was trying to buy gas and take it home and fill up the other car. Right. They didn't have a gas can. And I said, why don't you carry a gas can? You're a gas station. And they go, well, we only sell like five a year. And I'm like, okay, but like your customers that need it, it's absolutely urgent that they need it right then, like more urgent than anything else that they've ever bought from you. Right. And they're like, yeah, but we only sell like five a year. I go, okay. So I drove down to the next one because I had the car that had gas. And the next one had like 20 of them. And I go, man, why do you have so many gas cans? Right. And they go, because when our customers need it, it's the most urgent thing that they need. Right. And I go, well, that totally makes sense. Like, that's brilliant customer service. That's great. And I was thinking to myself, like, man, there's got to be an in between zero or 20 of them. Right. But then I bought one and it was like $60. And I was like, okay, you guys understand 80-20. Right. Because at that moment, I was going to pay for a gas can. Doesn't matter if it's 100 or 60, but what made me more mad than a $60 gas can was the person that didn't have one. Imagine if I had walked 2 miles from my car to that gas station and then they didn't have a gas can. That gas station would have never gotten my coffee, my lunch, my gas, my anything. It would have lost thousands and thousands of dollars by one mistake based on we don't sell it enough, right? So that's the 80-20 logic filter, where you have to understand what's the most important thing for your customers, what they'll pay for, and price it appropriately so that you can offer what they need, but also get paid the right amount of money to do so.
Thank you. Tell us other concepts that are part of the 20 books you mentioned earlier that most entrepreneurs and most CEOs read, and they implement these kind of concepts incorrectly, and that leads to failure or less profit.
One that I like to talk about a lot is kind of this decision democracy versus democracy, or sorry, decision dictatorship. And people don't like that word. I don't really care. So basically, the decision democracy is what's in all the books, right? Like, we need to get everybody involved. We need to talk it through. We need to get alignment. Alignment's talked about all the time in these books, and really make sure that everyone believes in the vision. And the best way to do that is to get everybody involved in the vision. What that ends up meaning is hundreds of hours of meetings. You're still not going to get everybody to agree. So there's going to be a handful of people, probably a decent chunk of people, that spent hundreds of hours in a meeting, and then you pick something else, which is even worse. So what I talk about is decision dictatorship. And what that is all about is not one person making all of the decisions. It's every decision has one decision maker. So every single decision has one decision maker. You might make two, I might make 20, somebody else might make 184, but every decision is only driven by one person. What that allows is for that one person to bring the meeting together when they need to learn about it so that they can make the decision of only the people who are going to add value to the meeting, right? And it goes back to kind of that meeting and the calendars, and can you cut down invites and cut down time, and too many times I'll ask people, like, okay, let me see this 13 person meeting. I go, when's the last time this person talked? Like, I can tell when I look at it, like, that supply chain person doesn't need to be in this meeting. When's the last time that person talked? Well, they've never talked in that meeting. They don't have to be there, right? They can get an email, or who talks the most, and they'll bring up somebody that talks the most, right? We all know that person. It's not the person who has the most value to add to the conversation is just the person that talks the most, right? So in a decision dictatorship, the person who's making the decision is in charge of their time and what they need to learn in order to make the decision. And that allows us to cut out hundreds of hours of meeting. That's the biggest thing that I catch people doing all the time. It's just this massive alignment that never, ever happens. They just spend hours and hours really, really pissing off the people who end up not getting their way. That's how it all works out.
Thank you. Is there any other concept from the 20 books that you mentioned that gets applied to businesses incorrectly?
Yeah, I would say the big one maybe is leadership and trying to judge and like what to do with employees when they're not working right. You know what I mean? So like there's the Jack Welch who's kind of like fire the bottom 40%. There's the other people that are like, try to coach him up and this and that. I actually believe that you shouldn't work on weaknesses. You need to lean into strengths. Okay, so a little bit of Jack Welch, but a twist on that is like, I'd rather work 50 hours a week on you doing the stuff that you're strongest at than work 50 hours a week on trying to fix your accounting if that's never going to be your strength and you're not going to like it either, right? So I do this thing called rapid reorg. And so when there is a backfill, so when somebody leaves the organization, we almost never backfill directly. So it's not this junior supply chain person leaves and we put a junior supply chain person in. We don't do that. We look for multiplier positions. And so it's basically when we call it a rapid reorg. So that person left. So what are you going to do with your team now? I want you to move the seats around so that people go into their strengths more. And then I want you to bring in a multiplier position that will make 3 to 5 people more productive. And so they might bring in a continuous improvement guy or a quality person that'll cut down on XYZ, during the sourcing process and things like that. So this rapid reorg versus trying to fix your employees, which they are insulted by, they don't like their job as much, and it's never going to work, or firing people like Jack Welch. There's this in-between where it's put them in the right seats and let them enjoy their job and be as productive as possible.
Thank you. Is there any other concept that you've seen people apply incorrectly in their business that you would want to see adjusted?
Yeah, I think that the biggest other one, probably from an operation standpoint, would be capacity. People have this weird thing where they always think they're at capacity. You know what I mean? They can't do any more. And so what ends up happening is they're looking at things and how busy they are rather than how much their actual machines are working to drive dollars. And so machine capacity versus operational capacity versus leadership capacity are all things that we talk about within the books. But it's basically a matter of you need to understand exactly how many hours your machines are working and how many hours they're down and how many hours they're waiting for the next machine or the last machine to do something. And you need to actually have a stopwatch and actually map out this value stream and figure out where your bottlenecks are. And so it's a little bit of theory constraints, which is one of the good books. And you really need to attack the bottlenecks. And what you'll end up finding is that there's 30 to 40% of capacity that you can free up usually without hiring anybody if you fix your system. But too many people are like, okay, we did $100,000 last year. We're on pace to do $120,000 this year. We need 20% more people. And typically you don't. You need 2 process improvements, and you can do that same $120,000 with the same number of people and just make more money.
Thank you. Tell us about implementing AI to deliver breakthrough results through also leveraging neurodivergent thinking.
Yeah. So AI is interesting because in my opinion, how AI is going to play out is if you are good at AI, you are going to drive more productivity through your job. But I don't believe that AI is going to replace a whole ton of jobs. It's more about person A is going to be slightly good. Person B is going to be really good. But if person A knows how to use AI, they're going to leapfrog person B because they're going to be slightly good, but be able to use AI to target themselves and make everything that they're doing more productive. That's how I use AI. So for example, like the top 10 things, like I might put my calendar into AI and be like, here are my top three objectives this year. Here are my top three objectives this quarter. And here are the big projects that are going to make us the most money. Please analyze my calendar and tell me if I'm working on the right things. And they might say something like, 27% of your, you know, calendar is admin. Is that really something you should be working on? There's these six ideas on how to outsource that, or there's four ideas on how to diversify and make sure you're doing the right amount of work at the right times. So those are the kinds of ways that I use AI. The other way are competitive and product research. It's actually really good. Like I can take a whole competitor's press release and a bunch of their news articles and financials if I've got a hold of them and drop them into AI and be like, give me a whole write up of the competitor. Like, what should I be worried about the next 3 years? What have they done the last 3 years? How would they react if I did X, Y, Z? And AI is a great tool for getting you to think about things like, oh man, if I did X, he might do Y. That'd be really bad. Would he really do that? Like, don't take it as fact, but they're going to come up with things that you didn't think about. And that's a great way to use AI. It's just kind of like a brainstorming game theory. You know, if I do this, what are they going to do? What might they do? What do I need to be aware of? If I don't want them to do X, is there a way to avoid that? Yeah, you do it this way, but you change this part of your strategy. You know what I mean? And AI can help you through like how to game theory out the situation, which I think is really valuable.
Thank you. Tell us, what do you use for this? Let's say to analyze someone's calendar, and also what would you use to track what they're actually using their time on?
Yeah. So I will tend to use Claude or Gemini are my favorite AI tools that I will use. But usually most of this stuff, the calendar stuff, you can do yourself. You know what I mean? You can literally just take their calendar and count the hours and figure out, you know, what they're doing, what they're spending their time on, and then have them tell you what they're doing in the open spots. That you can do without AI, but AI is helpful. But Claude and Gemini I found to be the best. And I think they both have free versions, especially if you're not overusing them, if you're just using them here and there. But even Microsoft, you know, Copilot has a good one out there.
Thank you. Tell us where entrepreneurs can connect with you.
Sure. Yeah, toddhagopian.com. I'm a big fan of people aren't going to read your book unless they've heard something you said or read something you wrote. So I put a ton of free information on toddhagopian.com. There's a bunch of podcasts on there, a bunch of articles on all these frameworks and how they work. And so definitely go on there, hit connect. You know, LinkedIn I'm on, and Twitter as well.
Follow us for more interviews with world's most influential business titans, providing you with the insights to awaken to your full potential so you can get paid to be yourself, find true happiness, and manifest anything you desire.